On March 18, 1981, the Nashua, New Hampshire Police Department received an unusual criminal complaint. The complainant, or as he was referred to in the report, the victim, showed up at the police station lobby to report that his life was being threatened. The victim explained that a few weeks earlier, he had been hanging out with a group of drinking buddies at Poor Bill's Pub in Merrimack, and they started talking about placing bets. The victim told his drinking buddies that he knew just the right man to get them some action on placing bets for basketball and hockey matches, a man named Alan Murphy. Murphy, the victim told the police, was a 30-year-old college-educated lab tech at St. Joseph's Hospital who ran a side hustle as a bookie. Every evening, Murphy would plant himself by the phone and start taking bets on sporting events. The drinking buddies all wanted in, so the victim made a call to place bets for them with Murphy. A few days later, the victim placed a second round of bets for the same group of drinking buddies. Two of those buddies lost a substantial amount of money, around $3,000, on those bets. In order to try and recoup these losses, the two men who had lost $3,000 wanted to place a number of larger bets, betting $1,500 per game for 5 games. The victim explained to the police that he was already in the hole to Murphy, the bookie, for the $3,000 that his buddies had lost, because he had, in effect, made the bets for them. So the victim wasn't sure what to do. He called Murphy and told him that his buddies wanted to place larger bets to recoup their losses, but that he wasn't really comfortable doing so, given that they hadn't paid up their earlier debt. But Murphy told the victim to go ahead and take the bets so that maybe he would get paid back for the earlier loss. And so the victim did. Of course, they lost that round of bets too, a loss of $12,000. The drinking buddies now owed the victim $15,000, which the victim owed the bookie. Right after losing that huge amount, though, the drinking buddies disappeared. The victim couldn't get a hold of them. And now the victim had come to the police station to report that for the past week, the bookie and the bookie's boss, a man named Roger, had been calling and threatening his life if he didn't pay up. The victim wasn't sure of Roger's last name, but he did know a man named Roger Govin, who worked as an FAA air traffic controller and was well known as a high roller in gambling circles. In fact, there had been rumors that Govin had once lost his actual house in a bet. Govin might be the same Roger that threatened him, but the victim wasn't sure. The victim, who certainly did not have the money to pay his friend's debts, had agreed to meet Murphy and Roger at the Naughty Night Bar and Nightclub at the Nashua Sheraton that very evening. But instead, he came straight to the police station because he was scared for his life. No worries, the Nashua police were on the case now, and they were going to make sure that the victim, 28-year-old Kenneth Edward Johnson, was protected. And welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 10, our season finale of The State versus Jason Carroll. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
No one becomes a compulsive gambler overnight, and that certainly wasn't the case for Ken Johnson either. He had been a gambling addict for a very long time before he concocted the story that he told Sharon about Bob owing him money. Back in 1981, when Ken made this police report, he admitted that before making bets with Murphy, he had been making them with a bookie in Massachusetts. Given that sports betting was illegal in New Hampshire at that time, it seems like a highly odd and risky move for Ken to go to the police and tell them about his involvement. It's likely that he certainly wouldn't have done so unless he truly feared for his life. After Ken made the report, Detective Sergeant Everett Korda came up with a plan while Ken was still at the station. He told him to call the Sheraton and have Murphy paged. Murphy came to the phone and spoke to Ken, a conversation that the police recorded. During the call, Ken asked for more time to repay the debt, and Murphy handed the phone to Roger. Roger asked Ken whether it was going to be money or a casket. Ken repeated his plea, asking for more time, and Roger hung up. A little while later, Ken called the Sheraton back. This time, Roger told him that Murphy had gone home and that they'd get back to him about an extension. Ken then called Murphy at home, and Murphy told him he had 2 days to get the money or that Ken could expect a visitor at his house, and then hung up. The police report notes that Ken next called his own house and spoke to his wife. She told him that she'd gotten a call from an unknown man asking for Ken. When she told the caller Ken wasn't home, the caller responded, "You better pay or he'll get it one way or the other." Because it seemed like Ken had bought himself a couple more days, the police sent him home and told him that they'd be in touch the next day. When Ken got home that night, Murphy called him and told him that he'd been granted a 2-week extension to pay the gambling debt. A little over a week later, two detectives met with Ken in the parking lot of the Little Lanes bowling alley to go over their plan. Roger had told Ken to meet him that night, the lounge in the Halua restaurant, to discuss how to pay back the debt, and to wear a leather jacket so Roger could identify him. But Ken was scared to meet Roger in person, afraid he was going to be attacked or even killed. The police assured him not to worry. Both of the detectives would be there to cover him. The plan was this. Ken would enter the lounge first and wait, and after a little bit, one of the detectives would follow him to the lounge and take up a position away from Ken, but from where he'd still be able to see anyone who approached Ken. The second detective would wait outside in an unmarked car. About 20 minutes after Ken took a seat at the Halua bar, a stocky, white, balding male in a bright red sweater took a seat next to him. The detective in the lounge sat further down the bar, but could hear the man introduce himself as Roger. He couldn't hear the entire conversation, but he saw Roger repeatedly shaking his head as Ken explained why he couldn't pay him just yet. Roger said something to the effect of maybe being able to help Ken find the drinking buddies that had stiffed him and put him in this position, and the officer then heard Ken say, "I'm scared," and Roger responded, "So am I." Then the band, which had been taking a break, came back on and drowned out the rest of the conversation. After 10 minutes, Roger got up and joined a table where a few other people were sitting. The detective outside waited until Roger left the restaurant and then followed his blue Buick with New Hampshire plates. When they ran the plates later that night, it turned out that Roger was in fact Roger Govan, the FAA air traffic controller. In the meantime, Ken had returned home, but when he spoke to the detectives over the phone after the meeting, he told them that Roger had made it clear that either Ken had to come up with the money or he was looking at a casket. A week later, Roger contacted Ken again and told him that he had 2 more days to come up with the money. Otherwise, he'd be charging him 2% a month on the balance owed and turning over the collection to someone else. Ken wouldn't be hearing from Roger anymore, he was told. Not long after, though, the police themselves reached out to Roger Govan and told him that they knew he'd been threatening Ken. Roger told them it was true that Ken owed him a lot of money and that he himself was scared because he in turn had to pay the money to some big, dangerous people. He was trying to take out a second mortgage to cover some of the debt, but he told the police that in case anything happened to him, to contact a colleague at the FAA who could tell them who the big, dangerous people were. This is where the police reports in this case end, and while we don't know if Ken ever paid back those debts, what we do know is he survived the threats. Initial investigators in the Sharon Johnson murder, the ones that came before Sergeant Lammy, had these reports from 1981 and continued to dig into Ken's gambling connections and problems. Part of that digging included searching for the two drinking buddies that had left Ken hanging with a massive debt to the dangerous people he was scared of. Despite searching through every New Hampshire database, including license and registration files, the police were unable to locate either of the two men that Ken had named as his drinking buddies. It seemed the two men had never existed, and the bets that put Ken in debt in 1981 were actually his own. Not unlike the story that Ken had concocted about Bob.
Ken seemed to have a pattern of pretending to place bets for others when he was in fact placing the bets for himself. But it wasn't a pattern that Sharon would have known about. She likely had no idea about the entire 1981 episode because she wasn't the wife that Ken called from the station the night that he reported the threat. Ken had called his first wife, Bernadette Paquette.
My name is Bernadette Ladone, previously Paquette and Johnson. I was married to Kenneth Johnson, 1978 to 81.
When Ken and Bernadette met, she already had an 8-year-old daughter, Lisa, who Ken adopted and gave her his last name when they married. After they got married, they had a daughter together named Julie. The marriage didn't last long, just a few years. In fact, just until after the time that Ken found himself being threatened for the debts that he owed back in 1981. But as far as Bernadette's concerned, they never should have been married in the first place. If she knew then what she found out soon after the marriage, she would have never married him.
Well, it shouldn't have probably even happened, who knows. But I was naive. I didn't know. I was 23. I did not understand or know anything about compulsive gamblers. And he was. I didn't know.
Unfortunately, she found out very soon what it meant to be married to a compulsive gambler.
And I only found out at the point where, on my honeymoon, he abandoned me. He convinced me to go to Atlantic City since I had never been, and then abandoned me there while he started gambling.
Ken didn't just abandon Bernadette and go gambling by himself on their honeymoon. He disappeared for entire days, and finally his new wife returned home.
Oh, you came home from the honeymoon by yourself?
Yes, I did.
Like, he just disappeared completely?
No. He just would disappear for 24 hours. So I, you know, he wanted me to, when he started telling me that I needed to stay longer, and not understanding that whole concept of what was behind this, I found out when I got home, is that he borrowed money to pay for the wedding that he wanted.
He borrowed money from you?
No. People that he obviously owed, which, you know, made him want to go get more money. He had kept Lane coming home, made me lie about that he was sick while we were there, and then at one point I just like, that's it, I'm going home.
And then, not long after the honeymoon, Ken pulled a disappearing act.
After the honeymoon. Honeymoon's in October. Think everything's going great. By January, he disappears. And I don't hear for 2 weeks, except via a postcard that he left and where he left my car. And so I was pretty wrung out by all of that.
So just so I can understand kind of how this happened, he just left home one day and you didn't know where he was going? And
yep. Nope. I said, oh, I'll see you tonight because I'm going to work. I got a waitress job. And he said, I'll see you tonight. Okay, bye. And that's it. And he's not coming home. And we don't have cell phones back then.
Right.
I have to call my mom in. She comes and watches Lisa. And I go to work. And then for the next couple days, I'm going crazy. File a police report.
Ken had taken off, leaving no note, no message behind. And worst of all, taking Bernadette's car with him. For 2 weeks, she had no transportation. And then she got the postcard.
All I got was a postcard. 2 weeks later,
from where?
He went to California and stayed there for 3 months.
For 3 months?
Yes.
Why? What did the postcard say?
Nothing. I don't even remember it anymore. But
do you think he was hiding from somebody?
Probably. He was running, probably running from people that he owed, probably.
After a few months, Ken showed back up, and Bernadette, well, she stayed with him. Having been divorced once before marrying Ken, she felt embarrassed of making yet another mistake.
Okay. And the fact that I even went back with them, stayed with them, is craziness. But anyways, I was embarrassed. I mean, what do you tell people?
Yeah.
Ken's gambling impacted their marriage throughout, but may have affected Bernadette even before their honeymoon.
The gambling caused all the strife, yes. Mm. Because it was secretive. Just like it had always been, I guess. I mean, I can look back afterwards and realize that he probably stole money from me, and I didn't realize it, that he lied. While we were dating, and I was on a business trip, and I came home, and the money that I had saved, what was cash in my drawer, he said we were robbed.
Wow.
And the police were there and everything else, and he made it look like, you know, somebody had been there type of thing.
Oh, he actually filed a police report.
But I didn't go and look for a police report. He said the police said there was nothing they could do, they did this. And, you know, being very naive, I went with it.
You believed him.
He was very believable.
It wasn't the first sign that something was terribly wrong. But of course, most signs are only recognized in hindsight. Bernadette wasn't naive enough to combine their finances, though. She made more money than Ken, and so she kept her accounts separate. And Ken was overly secretive about what he made and how he spent it.
At one point towards the end, he literally was locking his checkbook in his car.
To keep it from you?
Yeah.
What did he think you were going to do?
Find out what he was doing.
What he was doing, of course, was gambling away money he didn't have and getting deeper and deeper into debt, at a time when the couple certainly couldn't afford it.
By the time I'm 6 months pregnant, he starts changing. Then I get the phone call from a bookie that he owes. So there's now confrontation. I'm confronting him. I'm now not as stupid as I used to be. I know it, but I've stuck myself. Now, why do I find this out while I'm pregnant? Why can't I find out when I can still walk away? Anyways, that's what happened.
Bernadette did eventually walk away, but not before personally paying for a number of Ken's debts that were accumulated both from taking loans from loan sharks and from gambling. When the investigators in Sharon's case spoke to her in 1989, she provided them with copies of 5 canceled checks she'd written to pay the men that kept calling the house, copies she'd kept for a decade. In total, Bernadette paid nearly $3,500, which may not seem like a lot, but in 1979 it was. Today it's the equivalent of over $17,000. Not long after the incident that Ken reported to the police in 1981, Bernadette had had it. Ken was only getting worse, not getting any help, and she no longer wanted to deal with his lies, secrecy, and addiction. He'd recently forced her to co-sign on a loan, stolen cash she had in her car, and refused to get marriage counseling. And so, Bernadette decided to leave. But the night that she told Ken it was over was the first time that she saw a different side of him, a side that made her scared for her life.
He knows that he's losing control of even me now as well. And he got very upset with me. And at this point now, this is the first time he's violent with me, to the point where he's just... he's not letting me out the door, and he's just like corralling me. And then he grabbed my neck and pushed me up against the wall, and then walks away like it's nothing, because he had obviously been drinking. He was just ranting and raving that I wasn't getting out of there, and he wouldn't let me get to the door. He wouldn't let me get to the phone, because, you know, there's only like one house phone in the kitchen. Right on the wall. There's only one door out of this apartment. He's not letting me out. He's now pacing and he's just ranting. It's too bad the kids will never see you again. It's too bad the kids will have to live without you. I think that was the phrase. And he just kept going on and going on. And I just went to my bedroom, and thankfully he stayed in the living room and then passed out eventually. But I was feared for my life the entire night. I truly believed it was over for me.
The next morning, Ken acted like nothing had happened, and so did Bernadette. But she had a plan, a very brave plan.
I put my purse in the bottom of my laundry basket, told Lisa to take Julie out to go play. She didn't want her at first, and I'm like, just go to the play. Lisa, go stand by the car. Just go outside, go stand by the car. Just do what I say, and just do it. As they were out the door, I said, I'm going to go do the laundry. And I took, you know, what I could and took the laundry bucket with my purse at the bottom and took off.
Bernadette never turned back.
Investigators were learning a lot about Ken's past during the murder investigation, and it's reasonable to assume that Sharon herself might not have known any of it. She probably never knew that Ken abandoned Bernadette on their honeymoon, or disappeared for 3 months, or threatened to kill his first wife, or that he ended up in enough debt to fear for his life more than once. At some point in their relationship, however, Sharon came to learn about Ken's gambling problems, although we can't exactly be sure when. But there is a weird incident that pops up again and again in police reports, told to the police by multiple friends and family members of Sharon, that should have been a huge red flag for her. The date of this incident isn't clear, but at some point before they got married, Ken took off for Philadelphia all alone. He told one friend, who actually didn't seem to believe him, that he had gotten a new job and he was going to Philly for training. But what seems to have happened is that Ken stole Sharon's credit and ATM cards and then went on a gambling spree. According to one friend of Sharon's, whom the police interviewed, Sharon told her that a few days later she had gotten a call from either a hospital or the police in Philadelphia telling her to come and get Ken. When she brought him back, Ken acted as if he had amnesia. He told Sharon the only thing he could remember was that he had gotten mugged and beaten up, lost all of the money and credit and bank cards on him, but he couldn't remember anything else. He couldn't remember what he was doing in Philly, who had attacked him, or even where or when. Of course, a lot of Sharon's friends didn't believe the story. They thought he had stolen Sharon's money and concocted an elaborate lie to cover it up. What Sharon herself thought is impossible to know, but she dutifully canceled all her credit cards and eventually did go on to marry Ken after this incident. A number of people reported that Sharon thought Ken's gambling issues were behind him, they were in his past, because she had once confronted him about it and told him that he had to choose between her or his gambling, and that Ken chose Sharon. Unfortunately, it seems Sharon didn't understand how addictions like gambling work. Without help, often professional help, and a concerted effort at recovery, addictions only grow over time. It couldn't be as easy as Ken just making a choice, not when he had a compulsion that was out of control. Sharon might have initially believed the promise that Ken made, but it seems like close to the time of her murder, she had started becoming suspicious that Ken was once again gambling. According to Diane Eaton, Sharon's sister-in-law, just a couple of weeks before she was killed, Sharon had told Diane that if she found out that Ken was gambling again, she was done with him. It seemed like a threat that Sharon repeatedly made but didn't follow through with. In a police report of an interview with Lisa Johnson, she told the officer that in April of 1988, Sharon had found dog track tickets in Ken's pocket and confronted him about it. "They had a huge fight about it," said Lisa, one of many fights that seemed to be escalating in frequency leading up to Sharon's murder. The people close to Sharon knew things were getting worse in the months before she was killed, but no one was sure why. One possibility is certainly the gambling, because it does seem that Ken was under a lot of stress from debts that Sharon didn't even know about. You might remember from last week's episode, Ken's bookie, Craig Maxfield, testified for the state. On the stand, Maxfield said that he didn't know anyone named Bob. But in an earlier police report, Maxfield actually had told the police that Ken told him he wanted to place bets for someone by this name. Ken had begun placing bets with Maxfield in the fall of 1987, sometimes for himself and sometimes for this person named Bob. At one point, Ken had asked Maxfield if he knew anyone who could take larger bets for him, and Maxfield directed him to a man named Andy, who took the bigger bets. In December of 1987, Ken lost $5,800 to Maxfield during the College Bowl games, a debt that he could not immediately pay back. Sometime in the spring of 1998, however, Ken gave Maxfield a check for the $5,800 he owed him, but the check bounced. Ken then told Maxfield not to worry, Sharon would be getting her pension fund soon, and he would be able to cover the debt. Right after his big loss on the College Bowl bets, however, Ken told Maxfield that he was more worried about another debt than he was about the $5,800. Apparently, Bob, his friend, had lost $42,000 in the same college games, placing large bets with the other bookie. And then Bob had taken off to Aspen to go skiing. Bob's bets, as always, were placed through Ken, so Ken was on the hook for the debt. Of course, given what we know now, there was no Bob, just as there were no two drinking buddies in the 1981 incident. Ken had a pattern of pretending to take bets for people that didn't exist, which means that the $42,000 debt was Ken's to repay.
If Ken really did owe some big-time bookies over $40,000, he would clearly be under a tremendous amount of stress and maybe even fear for his life. Not long after the College Bowl games was when Ken pressured Sharon to take out a second mortgage on the house, ostensibly to do home improvements. But their neighbors reported to the police that, other than getting the driveway repaved, nothing else was done to improve the Johnson house. Perhaps Ken paid off some of the $42,000 he owed, but there's no way to know. What we do know is that right after Sharon was murdered, Ken told the police that they had been in dire financial straits and had been planning on asking her parents for a loan, which means the money from the second mortgage was gone by then. At every turn, it seemed Ken was looking to Sharon to cover his debts, in large part because it seemed he wasn't really working much. Ken had suffered a back injury the prior year and even had surgery for it, which may have accounted for his lack of employment. But it also seems that he was just a really awful worker. The oldest work-related documentation we have for Ken is a letter written in August of 1986 by a woman named Christine Johnson, who, at the time, was Ken's sister-in-law. The letter was addressed to Ken and had the chief of police of Greenfield, New Hampshire, CC'd on it. It reads, "Dear Ken, this letter shall serve as written confirmation of the conversation between yourself and Jim on Sunday, August 24th, 1986. Wherein you resign from the construction project and process at my home on Old Country Road in Greenfield, New Hampshire. This letter shall also serve as written notice that you and or your associates shall not be permitted on my property. Any attempt to come onto my property will be considered criminal trespass and be subject to arrest. Please direct any further communications regarding this matter to my attorney, Stephen Maynard. Sincerely, Chris." In 1987, Ken was working for Ashwood Homes as a purchaser and had some dealings with the Diamond Lumber Company. He made purchases of lumber from the company, but Diamond Lumber stopped doing business with Ken after he bought a cord of wood from them, and it took more effort than it was worth to get Ken to pay them for it. And that particular cord of wood probably never made it to Ashwood. Ken had, over the years, done work cutting trees and clearing land, and at one point began his own firewood business, splitting and selling wood, which may have been what his diamond lumber purchase was about. Sharon, her family reported, had paid for the equipment necessary for it, including tree cutting tools and a blue dump truck to haul wood. Ken wasn't always on the up and up with how and where he got the wood he sold. We have an undated police report that Ken had been cutting wood from someone's private property, likely in relation to his business, which seems to indicate that he didn't have the funds to buy the inventory. For this, and likely plenty of other reasons, This venture, like pretty much anything else Ken tried, sputtered out. Another part-time business that Ken started while he was working at Ashwood was building decks for new homes. He charged clients by the foot, which included the cost of labor and wood. At a number of sites, it turned out that the wood that was to be used for framing the homes would disappear, and Ken stood accused of stealing the framing wood to build his decks, rather than purchasing the wood he was paid for. Nonetheless, Ken told most of the people who knew him, including other construction workers, that he was so busy building decks he needed to hire people to help him. He told one friend that he had a contract to build 40 decks on new constructions in the summer of 1988. About 2 months before the murder, Ken was hired by Audley Construction, but lasted there only 4 weeks before quitting. If he hadn't quit, the foreman would have fired him soon anyway, because, according to him, Ken never really wanted to work. He always seemed buzzed, like he'd been drinking, and showed up to work glassy-eyed and red-faced. He was lazy, said the foreman, and never completed a day's work. Audley Construction happened to be where Ken met Stephen Sprague. You might remember Sprague from last week's episode. He was the man who testified that Ken had arranged to meet with him on the evening of July 28, 1988, to discuss hiring Sprague to help him build decks. Sprague, in turn, told another man, Chuck Letson, of the opportunity, and both men agreed to meet Ken at Sprague's house to discuss the details. That night, Chuck went over to Sprague's house to wait for Ken, but Ken never showed up, never called either. They didn't know until days later that it was the same night that Ken's wife had been murdered.
Ken's spotty employment and failed business ventures didn't help when it came to repaying his gambling debts. In fact, his bookie Maxfield never was able to recoup his $5,800 loss, even when Sharon's thrift fund came in, because Ken spent most of it within a few days. The stress of the gambling debts may have been why fights were escalating between Sharon and Ken, but there's one more terrible possibility for why things were so bad between them. It may have been that Ken and Sharon found out the sex of the baby they were having, and Ken wasn't happy about it. Now, this is all a bit confusing, because according to the early police reports, everyone the investigators spoke to said that Sharon and Ken did not know the sex of their child. According to Diane Eaton, the wife of Sharon's brother, 2 weeks before she was murdered, Sharon had gone in for an ultrasound to determine the baby's sex. But when she got back, Sharon told Diane the doctor wasn't able to make a determination. Another friend of Sharon's reported the same thing to the police, that despite getting an ultrasound, Sharon wasn't able to determine the sex of the baby. But Sharon hoped and prayed it was a boy for Ken's sake. Ken, this friend told the police, wouldn't accept a girl. Without question, Ken wanted a boy. Everyone knew he wanted a boy because he told everyone he did. According to Melanie, he'd already declared that the baby was his son and had bought the baby little boy pants. When Trooper Thomas Sexton asked him after the murder if he knew they were expecting a boy or a girl, Ken responded that a nurse had told him that the baby had a boy's heartbeat. Now, of course, you can't tell the sex of a fetus from its heartbeat, though it's an old wives' tale. Ken also told Sexton that as far as he knew, no test or scan had been done to determine if the baby was a boy or a girl. Still, Ken seemed committed to the idea that the baby had been a boy, and in numerous reports after the murder, he lamented about losing his son. In one report, Melanie also referred to the baby as her brother. It didn't seem like they knew what they were having, but Sharon was hoping for the sake of the marriage and Ken's happiness that the baby was a boy. She'd even told her therapist that she thought having a boy would pull the family together. But again, from all the documentation in this case, no one knew what the baby was. In fact, just 2 days before she was murdered, Sharon had a dental appointment to get her teeth cleaned. The dental technician reported to the police that Sharon had seemed happy and relaxed, and told her that both Ken and she wanted and expected a boy. And after Sharon's murder, the newspaper reported that Sharon had told friends and family that she was excited to have the baby and expected that she was having a baby boy. So here's where the confusing part comes in. All these years later, a number of people we spoke to have told us without hesitation that Sharon absolutely knew what she was having, and it wasn't a boy.
And the only other thing that really stands out that I felt was kind of strange when she found out what she was having for sex, the baby, He was very disappointed. He wanted a boy. And she was having a girl.
She did know. She
was having a girl. So
that's
she.
That's, like, well, and but other people we've talked to said, no, she didn't know yet what she was having. And I had a feeling that she did know and had played it close to the vest.
Yeah.
Because he wanted a boy so badly.
Exactly. She had just started talking with me about that. And I told her, I said, don't worry about that. I said, because as soon as that baby's born and he sees her, he is going to love her. But I could tell that she really had some feelings around that and that it wasn't going to be accepted.
That's Carlene Webb, the coworker who called Ken multiple times from Sharon's workplace the morning that she failed to show up. The other voice you hear is Sarah Kalin, our investigator, who had theorized early on that Sharon had found out that the baby was a girl, but perhaps hadn't told Ken yet, at least not at the point when she first told Carlene.
And I just felt like the few things she had said about she felt like she wasn't deserving of him, and then she was worried about him finding out that, you know, they were having a girl and he really wanted a boy. And those are the things that stand out the most to me.
Lucy Holt, the friend of Sharon's whose husband had accidentally divulged that Sharon had a significant thrift account, also knew that Sharon was having a girl.
Can I ask you something? Do you know if she was having a boy or a girl at the time?
Having a girl, and he did not want girls. He thought this was, and I think she named it Amanda. She had that name picked out.
She told you. Let me just ask again. She definitively told you that she was having a girl. They knew that.
Yeah.
Given that a couple of Sharon's friends knew she was having a girl, we thought maybe, possibly, she had confided in friends, but not yet her own family. Maybe she'd been killed before she could. But then we asked Lisa Johnson about it.
Did you know? Did Sharon ever share with the family whether she was having a girl or a boy?
I believe we knew she was having a girl, because I remember she had already given her a name. I want to say it was Amanda, something like that.
If Lisa, who was living in Rhode Island at the time that Sharon got her ultrasound, knew that Sharon was having a girl, even knew the name she'd picked out for the girl, it's safe to assume that Ken knew too, which would mean his lamenting over the loss of a son after Sharon's murder was all one big act. And with all the importance that Ken put on having a son, on refusing to accept a baby girl, did learning that the baby wasn't a boy push Ken over the edge? To former Trooper Thomas Sexton, the crime itself is one of rage.
The thing that strikes me is you told me about the number of stab wounds. That sounds like anger. I can't imagine young kids stabbing some pregnant woman who they've never met in their lives or whatever that many times. I don't get it.
It makes you wonder, if Sharon had been pregnant with a baby boy, would she still be alive today?
After getting Sharon's thrift fund and making the mini initial payments, Ken continued to spend down the money. On November 16th, 1988, Ken met with Bernadette's sister at Massachusetts Howard Johnson's. The sister, Annette Guillen, told police that he looked like a wreck, seemed depressed and nervous, and wouldn't answer any questions about what he was up to or what he had planned. Ken handed Annette $8,000 in cash and told her to get it to Bernadette for the girls. Ken wanted to meet Annette, who was a single mother, again, but Bernadette told her to be careful and not meet Ken privately anywhere. So Annette met with Ken twice more for lunch at the Howard Johnsons, and each time Ken was acting strange, and once he'd called her while drunk, looking for Bernadette. Investigators checked out the Howard Johnsons and spoke to a couple of the employees at the bar and restaurant who identified Ken as someone they had served. Both employees noted that Ken had been there multiple times, often to meet a woman with a baby, and stayed there for hours drinking. They found him strange, saying he wouldn't talk, would sometimes sit alone for hours, and was often crying. Ken seemed to be in a bit of a downward spiral. He no longer had any of the cars, and within months of the murder, had begun to borrow money from others again, including from his daughter Lisa. By March of 1989, Ken had moved back to Rhode Island and checked into a rehab center at the urging of his brother Tom, who himself was a recovering alcoholic. Later that year, of course, Ken would be arrested and charged with murder. Ken was living with his sister when he was charged and was in at least $8,000 of debt. A Boston Globe article published shortly after Ken, Tony, and Jason were arrested began as follows. From the moment Sharon Johnson picked up the tab on their first bowling date, life with Kenneth Johnson was a losing proposition. The more Sharon earned as an electrical engineer, the more Kenneth seemed to squander as a gambler. Bills went unpaid. One loan led to another. After 3 years of marriage, with their first baby on the way, Sharon Johnson had told her parents she wanted out. "Don't tell him," her mother warned her. "He'll kill you." The article went on to say that Ken had been motivated to kill Sharon for her life insurance proceeds. Ken, however, was blocked by the court from drawing the life insurance money, and eventually Ken forfeited his claim to Sharon's life insurance, so the proceeds were distributed to Melanie instead. Ken spent nearly 2 years in jail before being released in October of 1991. All of his charges dropped. From there, we lose track of Ken's life and story, and only know that he's been dead for a very, very long time now. According to Bernadette, he drank himself to death. According to Melanie, he fell down the stairs and had a brain aneurysm. No one we spoke to bothered to find out how he died, because Ken didn't leave anyone behind lamenting his death. Melanie, Sharon's daughter, had spent years dreaming about killing him, and Sharon's sister-in-law Diane called it good riddance. Bernadette said that what he did was now between him and God.
The night before Sharon's murder, Ken had been spotted by a foreman with Oddly Construction as he drove past their construction site. Ken had long ago quit working for them, but around 5 p.m. on July 27, 1988, he was driving his blue Subaru past one of their construction sites right off of South Willow Street, heading eastbound on Route 101. Now, to give you some orientation, what this basically means was that the night before the murder, Ken was spotted driving past a construction site that was right next to the Mall of New Hampshire, a good 20-odd miles from his own home, and he was headed in the direction of where his wife's body was left the next night. The following day, on the last day of Sharon Johnson's life, Ken went to meet her for lunch. To refresh your memory, after Sharon's body was found, Ken told the police that his car was muddy because before meeting her for lunch, he had checked out a sand pit where they could have sex, but decided against it because it was raining. So if the rain prevented their nudity, that would seem to suggest that their trysts usually took place outdoors. Ken told the police that he drove home in the rain, and yet the mud remained on his car, and that he never saw his wife again. I have a different theory, and it's a theory that former trooper Thomas Sexton shares with me.
I could see that Ken said to her that night, "Hey, just, you know, let's go out to the sand pit and do it again and just relive them, whatever." I think he would have convinced her to go to that sand pit to have sex. I really do. What other reason?
Remember, Sexton was told by nearly everyone he interviewed, including Ken, that Sharon had an insatiable sexual appetite that only Ken could satisfy. That was the narrative. But it might have been a narrative that Sharon spread herself to cover for Ken. According to Sharon's mother, Sharon knew that no one liked Ken. So she was careful not to tell anyone else things about him that would make them like him even less. Anne could also account for Sharon telling most of her friends that Ken was such an incredible lover that she couldn't get enough. In reality, though, according to one couple, a couple that Sexton did not interview but was rather interviewed by Detective Sergeant Morency, it was Ken who demanded sex multiple times a day, not Sharon, and that as Sharon's pregnancy was progressing, she couldn't handle it. So if Ken didn't get his noonie that day at lunch, it would have been an easy excuse to convince Sharon to come with him that evening for a quickie somewhere else. If that was what happened, it would also account for something that the lead investigator himself, Sergeant Roland Lamy, was still bothered by all of these years later.
The one thing that bothered me, and I don't know where it was good, but there's no question that that this poor 9-month pregnant woman, in broad daylight in a shopping parking lot, got forced into that car, not just by one guy. You know, it does make sense. So I'm sure she would have screamed or done something, you know, to attract attention.
Now, before I get into my conversation with Mr. Lammy, I need to put something out there. Our initial contact with law enforcement in this case was with Thomas Sexton, who spoke to Sarah Kalin, my investigator, at length before he spoke with me. Both Sarah and I explained what we were doing to Mr. Sexton and told him that this investigation was part of an effort through a podcast to bring awareness to this case. Mr. Sexton then sent Mr. Lammy our way. Mr. Lammy seemed to know what I was doing and agreed to let me record the conversation, and repeatedly said that he was sure he didn't need to talk to the AG's office to get cleared since he was only answering basic questions. He also asked me whether or not I had gone through the Attorney General's office, but I told him no. I also told him, though, that I was happy to do so if that's how he would speak to me. But I said if it wasn't a concern to him, then it wasn't a concern for me. And so we had a great half an hour conversation. Mr. Lammy thanked me for being professional and polite. We exchanged cell phone numbers, and we agreed to be in touch as needed. A few weeks later, Mr. Lammy got in touch with me to tell me that there was a local journalist who wanted to speak to him about the case, and Mr. Lammy wanted to know if I thought he should speak to him. I told him sure, why not? I knew and trusted the journalist, and that it was his choice ultimately, but I saw no reason why he shouldn't speak to him. And that was when Mr. Lammy said to me that he was worried that the journalist would want to record him and put him on the radio. And then I kind of froze, because it was the first time I realized that even though Mr. Lammy gave me permission to record him, maybe he didn't realize I was recording him for the podcast. Or maybe he did, and he was just opposed to this other journalist recording him. I had no idea. I didn't say anything at the moment, but we had another pleasant conversation, and he invited me to have coffee with him the next time I was in New Hampshire. When I got off the phone, I thought about how to handle this for weeks, and I consulted with some colleagues about what to do. As far as I had known, Mr. Lammy agreed to talk to me, knowing full well about the podcast from Thomas Sexton. Now I wasn't so sure. I thought about reaching out to Mr. Lammy to clarify what the audio would be used for, but then what if he told me I couldn't use it? Here's the thing, though. Under New Hampshire law, once Mr. Lammy gave me permission to record him, I could do what I wanted with it. But if I reached out now and asked him and he said no, I might feel a little cornered into not using it. The truth is, I don't have a legal obligation to tell Mr. Lammy what the audio is for, and I didn't have to get explicit permission to use it for the show. But you could argue that I have a moral obligation. Eventually, I thought long enough about the issue to come to the conclusion that Mr. Lammy had spent his career walking up to the line of what the law allowed, sometimes well beyond what was ethically acceptable. He was a tough guy, and if he could dish it, then he could take it. Plus, there was this. I was pleasantly surprised by Mr. Lammy's reaction to the effort to exonerate Jason Carroll. If anything, our conversation put Mr. Lammy in a positive light and helped me to understand why he went after Jason. Finally, I decided that having heard so much about Mr. Lammy, it was only fair to our listeners that they got to hear directly from him.
So Neil and I guess, got the confessions from Jason Cowell.
Right.
We went to State Armory and interviewed him, and the rest is in the record books and reports, but that was a very difficult case. So anyway, what I think is important to save your time, because, you know, talking at Sexton, that's okay. He's a real good investigator. But what I don't think you're aware of, prior to me going there as the lead investigator, there were two other lead investigators before me,
mm-hmm.
That work in harmony with Bedford PD, and they had their own teams, like Eastman, I think, who worked for Marty Heehan, who has now passed away, and I think Sloper, who made Colonel, went down there for a while, and he was, I don't know which guys he picked, but There were different guys that worked for these two leads. You follow me?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you interview who you want, you're going to do it anyway. But what I'm saying, those guys didn't do, they were never put on the stand.
Right.
And they didn't do that many interviews. So at some point, I got sent down there, and I took Neil Scott.
What Sergeant Lammy is trying to say here, but being polite about, is that two sets of investigators didn't do a very good job, which was why they sent him. The small objection I'll make here is to note that the initial investigators actually did many, many, many interviews. Remember how hard they worked just to find Bob? But then they are also the same investigators who failed to search Ken's house. Anyway, Sergeant Lammy explained to me that he and Scott had a list of people the initial investigators had interviewed, likely the same interviews that he didn't really read, and so Scott and him went out to interview everybody that had not yet been spoken to. My guess is the thinking here is that if those initial interviews didn't lead to an arrest, there was no point in circling back to them. Sergeant Lammy's task was to find the evidence that they did not yet have, something they could base an arrest on. And that's what they were doing, just routine interviews, when they got to Jason Carroll.
What happened is that Jason gave us a statement, and you know that.
Mm-hmm.
And his mother was present during some of it. And then at the PD, there was always, during this confession stuff, a member of the Attorney General's office. It was obvious it was something troubling him.
Mm. And you got to Jason because of Tony. Because originally you were thinking Tony helped
somehow involved.
Yeah. And then was there a reason you thought, well, Tony must have been involved, but Tony must have had help? Or it was just that you were doing interviews and something seemed off with Jason. Is that what happened?
Basically, that's what happened.
Okay.
We felt that Johnson was definitely involved. And he paid somebody to do it. So it ended up we arrested Tony Puff and then Kenny Boy, the husband.
I had to ask why, though. Why did they decide that anyone other than Ken was involved?
I'm wondering why, since Ken didn't have an alibi for the night, the decision was, or the theory was developed that he paid others to do it. Why could he have not just committed the murder himself?
He could have done that too.
He could have, okay. But you didn't think it. You had a sense that that's not what happened.
Well, I knew we couldn't talk to him. We didn't want to talk to the police. So we picked up as much of available evidence as there was. He was a gambler. He owed money. He was a liar. You know, he was a lowlife.
His reason was as simple as that. They couldn't get anything from Ken, so they had to find someone, anyone that could help deliver him. And so they kept prodding and poking, got to Tony fairly easily because he was an unsavory character with a record who had a connection to the Johnsons. And from there, they got to Jason. In essence, Mr. Lammy told me that Jason only became a suspect during their interview, and that going into it, he had no suspicion of him. What Mr. Lammy might be forgetting is that he was systematically pressuring those connected to Tony, like the cleaning crew leader, George McDonald, to confess that they were involved with the murder. That is the core of the Reed technique, to accuse a suspect until they give in. A reminder that this high-pressure technique is named after a former Chicago police officer named John Reed, who was able to extract a confession from a man named Daryl Parker, who admitted to murdering his wife. It's no small irony that Parker recanted his confession the very next day, but was still convicted despite the recantation. Later, Parker was exonerated when the guilty party was identified. So instead of having proven itself to be a dangerous failure, the Reed technique flourished, and law enforcement officers since the 1950s have been trained in it. And that was Mr. Lammy's method all along. That was why he was so successful in getting confessions throughout his career. And someone like Jason just simply couldn't hold up under the pressure.
Can I ask you something? If Jason had not given any confessions at all, What would there have been any basis other than his confessions to charge him?
When I went to the Army, he was this Jason Carroll, the son of this policewoman, who was very pleasant. If he hadn't, I was a lead investigator, and I was pretty successful at what I did.
I've heard.
And the whole idea was to do, you know, the grunt work. To answer your question, knowing that I'm on tape, I have to say that if he hadn't acted up the way he did, you know, if he'd been casual, I'm not saying I would have interviewed him, not interviewed him, you know, in the following weeks, but based on that kind of an interview, I would have had no reason at the time to interview. It was suspicious.
Okay.
Does that help?
If Jason hadn't folded under interrogation techniques designed to make people, both innocent and guilty, confess, it seems that Sergeant Lammy would have likely moved right along to someone else. There doesn't seem to be any doubt, however, in his mind that Jason's confessions were legitimate.
I'm gonna put you a little bit on the spot, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to. But I'm wondering, do you think is there any possibility, because you were there in those two or three days with Jason. I mean, I wasn't there. There's no videotape of it. Do you believe that
Neil Scott was too?
Right, and Neil Scott was there, and his mother was there. But do you believe that there's any possibility that the confessions could have been false?
When he began confessing at the Armory, his mother was not present. I'm the one that called her in after about 4 hours, two, three hours.
Mm.
And she came with her husband, and she was very broken out naturally. But so, yeah, that confession, and keep in mind, when we went to the PD, you know, to take a more detailed confession, there was an attorney general present during the whole time. The police chief was there. The local police were there. I mean, there was a house full of cops.
Is that your way of saying no?
Pretty much for now, yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much for now isn't a completely definitive statement. And when I explained to Mr. Lammy that we were hoping to exonerate Jason, well, he didn't object.
First of all, I'm trying to figure out exactly what happened, why it happened, and then, you know, maybe we can convince the district attorney if we take this to them and say, look, this is, can we just DNA test at least her fingernail clippings? Because I do think she definitely fought back really hard when she was being attacked. She fought back hard.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So whoever attacked her, whoever was stabbing her, choking her, that guy's
and
DNA.
Wrapping a clothesline around her neck and dragging her.
Yeah. It was brutal. But her fingernail clippings could tell us a lot about who that person was, I think.
I am surprised that Jason Carroll is still there, because I've heard no bad reports about him. Not that I check up on him, because it's difficult getting information out of there. But I'm surprised he's still there.
Mm. How would you feel about any DNA in this case being tested?
Well, you know, I believe in fair play and the truth. If you can get something DNA tested that will show that he's not guilty, that's fine by me.
I did make a mental note that Mr. Lammy mentioned a clothesline, something that doesn't appear anywhere in the record, but certainly would line up with the medical examiner's original determination that a ligature was used to strangle Sharon. Of course, it's been a very long time since he worked on this case, and this could have just been a slip of memory or tongue. Before we ended the call, though, I wanted to share my theory, which also happens to be Sarah Kalin and Thomas Sexton's theory, with Mr. Lammy.
Can I tell you my theory?
Yes.
My theory is, just having learned a lot about Ken and hearing from every single person related to him and who knew him, and also his timeline, because he disappears after 6 o'clock, he disappears. But he knew where his wife was going to be. My theory is that, and you might remember this actually, so many witnesses said that they had a habit of sneaking away just in a car and just having sex in public places. Like, they did this all the time.
Yeah.
My theory is that he went to the mall and found her there and said, why don't you get my car, let's go for a quickie. And then he took her to construction. And so she didn't fight or anything. And they maybe even started making out. She takes off her shirt, that kind of thing. I think that's why, I don't think she could have been forced right there in front of everybody. I agree with you on that.
Too many people.
Yeah. Yep, you're right.
But your theory is certainly a good theory.
Yeah. Yeah.
If this theory is true, that Ken tricked Sharon into going for a drive for a quickie, Sharon likely left her car behind somewhere around the mall, got into Ken's car with her purse, and then they drove together to the construction site. Maybe Ken urged her to step out of the car to have sex, and then unbuttoned a few of the buttons on her pants, as if that was what they're going to do. Or maybe they got out of the car, they were making out, and Sharon herself removed her shirt in the car and left it there, which is why it was never found. Or possibly, Ken strangled her with it and took the two murder weapons with him, the shirt and the knife. Maybe. It's all a theory for now. Even given all that we know, we don't know enough to solve this murder. And do you know who knows even less? Jason Carroll.
Hello?
Hello. This is a prepaid debit call from...
Jason.
This is a call from an inmate at the New Hampshire Department of Corrections. To accept this call, press 0. To refuse this call, hang up, or... This call is from a correction facility and is subject to monitoring and recording.
Thank you for using Global Tellink.
One of the complications of working on this during COVID was that pretty much every prison across the country shut down visits, including Jason's. Which made sense because you have an essentially captive, very vulnerable population, and if the virus got inside, it would be impossible to control. Still, it usually got inside, and Jason ended up infected.
No, I caught it.
Oh, God.
I caught it bad.
Oh, my God.
I caught it bad. Yeah, pretty much the whole prison caught it. A lot of us just wouldn't say anything because they were just up and moving me for no reason, you know, trying to quarantine you. But the thing is, everybody on the block had it, you know? So we were just like, we refused to... temperature checks, everything until everybody was pretty much done with it. And then we were quarantined for, I think, 34 days.
34 days?
Yeah, 32, 34 days, yeah.
Thankfully, Jason recovered without any significant long-term effects. But until fairly recently, the lockdown remained. If you listened to the first season of the podcast Serial, you might remember Deidre Enright, the director of the UVA Innocence Project, saying that the least helpful person in their own defense is an innocent person. This holds true again and again across our cases, because innocent people inherently have no idea what happened in a crime. And oftentimes, especially in older cases, they aren't able to account for their time or provide an alibi. In this case, Jason was interrogated and arrested 16 months after Sharon's murder. If he didn't recall a single thing about the night of July 27th, 1988, it would have been completely understandable. But there was one reason that Jason did recall that night.
I remember the night because I quit. I quit my job. That's how I remember the night.
We know that's true because according to Jason's boss, he not only didn't show up that night, he never showed up again at that job. Here's what Jason remembers of that night.
I know... You said in different versions of the confessions that you dropped Tony off in Manchester to go to work at Windsor House or something to go to work.
Webster House.
Webster House, excuse me, yeah. So did that part of that actually happen that night?
Yes, it did. I actually dropped him off. And we were hanging out downtown. And I do remember Tony coming around. He needed a ride to work, and I did drop him off. And I kind of stayed back because I didn't want to be seen because I did not want to go to work.
Yeah.
I hated it.
Yeah, apparently the supervisor still saw you, your truck parked around the corner when he picked up Tony.
Yeah, that's right.
After dropping Tony off, Jason believes he just went back downtown and hung out with some friends, which is what the kids did nearly every night, until they finally got bored or tired and went home. But he's not sure of who he hung out with or what time he went home. Doesn't remember if he tried to tell Sergeant Lammy where he was that night or tried to tell anyone.
And I'm sorry, I don't recall a lot of things, but a lot of stuff is just, I've blocked out.
Yeah. It's okay, I understand. What about with your defense counsel? Once you had attorneys, did they ask you to try to figure out what you were doing that night? I mean, like, did they ever think we got to establish an alibi? Was that part of the defense plan?
I don't know, Robbie. I don't know what to say. I don't know.
Okay. Do you remember the interrogations at all, though?
A lot of it's blocked out of my mind.
Some things about the interrogations he remembers very clearly.
I do remember a lot of it was traumatic.
Can you talk about why?
Because I was being accused of something I didn't do and nobody believed me. Nobody fucking believed me. Excuse my French.
Yeah.
Nobody believed me. And they wouldn't let up.
Was it your impression that if I can just help these guys nail Tony and Ken, then, like, you know, they'll lay off me?
Well, they were just out to, I don't think there's any kind of impression. They were just out to, they didn't, I'm trying to get my words right. They didn't give a shit about anything. They just wanted to nail anybody and anything they could.
And while he doesn't remember the details of what he said in any of these interrogations, he does remember how it felt when he went home after the first confession.
When you went home,
yep.
Did you guys talk about what had just happened?
No, nothing was talked about.
So you didn't get in the car and say, Mom, this is all bullshit. Like, none of this happened.
I tried doing that one day at home, and I think it was the next day. Listen, this is bullshit, and then she just dragged my ass right back.
Yeah, so the next day you wanted to recant, and she contacted the police to say, my son wants to recant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because I was finally able to get a breath, you know, and get my head clear. What the hell was going on? And then, boom, dragged me right back, and right back in it again, right in the soup.
The soup was much more intense the next day, when his mother joined the interrogation herself.
Can you tell me what impact it had on you to have your mother in the room?
That was the worst, because she didn't believe me and she's acting just like they were.
Was she really pressuring you?
Of course. They just started beating me down again. I was so mentally exhausted. I remember trying to sleep. I remember trying, you know, I remember calling her into the table just trying to get some sleep. Nope. It was like pure bullshit and pure hell. That's what I remember. I remember being yelled and screamed at, you know, to say something that I didn't do. Nobody believed me. They didn't care. Every time I tried to say, listen, it's not happening, they wasn't hearing it. It was like I was just being beat down like a mutt.
Do you think you finally just confessed to just make them go away? To make it stop?
Pretty much, that's what I think. Yeah, to make it stop.
When asked if Jason himself had a theory of the crime, of who killed Sharon, how or why, he had no idea. He still wasn't sure if Tony was involved or if Ken had been involved, and he wasn't clear on many of the details of the case file itself. Some things he was hearing for the first time on the call.
So, the day that her body was discovered, that day the police went to Ken's house, and they took his car. They found... Okay, according to the evidence collection sheet, they found a knife in his car. And I'm wondering if that's something your attorney ever talked to you about, if you remember coming up at trial. There are portions of the trial transcripts also missing, so I don't know what I'm missing. but do you remember knowing that Ken had a knife in his car?
No.
You never heard that before?
No.
Jason doesn't remember much of his trials, doesn't remember who testified and who didn't, but he does remember a juror beginning to cry when they rendered a guilty verdict. But other than that detail, he numbed out. Couldn't hear what the jury foreman was saying or what the judge was saying. He just heard guilty, saw the juror cry, and blocked the rest out. A question we've gotten repeatedly from listeners is this. How is Jason's relationship with his mother now? What happened between the two of them after all this? You might recall that after Jason was arrested, his family moved away, his father being concerned about the impact of everything on the other children. His parents left him behind after making things worse.
Yeah, because they're trying to cut deals from what I know now. You know, they're trying to and all they did was make things worse.
Yeah. Do you think your mom realizes that today, that she made it worse?
Oh my God, yes. I mean, my relationship, you know, you only have one mother in life. You know, it took me a long, long time to forgive her for what she did. But I still have bouts of frustration and anger towards her. It's I can't help it. Well, the fact that, you know, during the course of everybody just want to pack up and move away, and, you know, and I'm left to my own devices.
When Jason was arrested, his three younger siblings were a 17-year-old sister, a 15-year-old brother, and a 12-year-old sister. Other than the fact that Jason was facing murder charges, the children, including Jason, were also devastated by learning for the first time that John Carroll wasn't Jason's father. Jason was a half-brother to the other three children. Jason himself didn't learn this until after his arrest. While he wasn't able to maintain much of a relationship with the older of his siblings, he did his best to be a big brother to 13-year-old Jackie.
You know, I would call home, and, you know, I would figure she'd be having problems or somebody had problems, and I would talk to her, and like, okay, listen, you don't want to go down this road. And I tried to be the big brother that I could be from where I was, and obviously it helped because, you know, she ended up graduating high school because of me.
And once Jackie Carroll graduated from high school, she set out to find out what had happened to her big brother.
The Carroll household was a tight-lipped one. Not a lot of conversation between parents and kids in general. And when Jason was arrested, that didn't change. Jackie and her siblings had no idea what happened to their big brother. They just knew that he had disappeared and that something was wrong.
Well, we were kept in the dark, my other two siblings and myself. And, you know, like I was telling Cynthia, when the suits, because it was all men, that's just how I refer to them, when the suits would come around, my parents would say, you know, stay in your rooms or go to a friend's until we come for you. Mm-hmm. So we weren't understanding anything. They weren't talking to us about it.
Right.
The only thing we kept asking was, where's Jason? We never got that answer. You know, what's going on? Where's Jason? And we didn't, like I said, we didn't get that answer until the night we had to go say goodbye to him. Oh, it was horrible. It was going on 11 o'clock that night. And let's see. Of course, my mom and dad weren't home. It was just us three youngest kids. And my mom came in. Us three kids were in the living room. My mom came in. She says, get your jackets. Let's go. First thing out of our mouths were, where's Jason? And she goes, just get your jackets and let's go. So we always do as we're told. So we did. And we get to the police department. So we went into the room and there Jason was. And there was two men, one being Roland Lammy. The other was Captain Morency. Captain Morency, which he's passed away now. And Roland Lammy, He says, you guys have 5 minutes to say goodbye. And he wouldn't even take Jason's handcuffs off of him so we could, you know, do a proper goodbye. And again, nobody's telling us anything as to where he's going. And so, you know, like I told Cynthia, I said, we look like a bunch of orphans, you know, huddled together. And somebody grabbed him by the forearms and it's time to go. And they were ushering him to another door. And I was starting to follow suit. And somebody grabbed me by the back of my shoulder and said, no, you can't go. So I don't know where they took my brother from the other side of the door. That was the last time I had ever seen him.
Their parents never ever discussed what was happening, never explained anything to Jason's siblings. But of course, that didn't shield them from the fact that everyone around them knew.
I believe it was in 91 we ended up back in South Carolina because I had beat up my social studies teacher because she made a comment to me. And my father's like, okay, enough's enough.
About now, Jason the youngest, or?
In reference to Jason. I mean, it was a Friday, and I remember it well. Couldn't remember her name to this day. It was a Friday. We had a test, and I was one of the last ones to turn it in and leave. And she grabbed my paper, and it was kind of like we both still held onto it, and it was kind of like a tug of war. And she leaned into me. She goes, I hope he rots in hell. And that was it. I lost it.
Oh,
I blacked out. I beat the shit out of her. Pardon my language.
At this point, the Carrolls decided that they had to move away from New Hampshire. Jason was still awaiting trial, though, so when they left the state, he essentially had no family left there for him. For years, Jackie wasn't sure where her big brother was and had no information about the facts of the case or how Jason got convicted. But when she turned 18, she decided to figure it all out.
So when did you start learning more about kind of the details of the case?
That wasn't until I basically said, well, screw this. If I'm going to find out, I've got to do it on my own. So I was about 18 is when I started sinking my own fingers into it. But my parents always had some discovery material on Jason's side, and that's where I started. And as far as internet and stuff, of course, I had to go with what was available to me at the times, you know, coming up. And it was basically all book trail that I had to follow and start from there. And then the internet really kicked in. I'm like, okay, let me see if I can teach myself how to do this. And, you know, I started going through the internets and stuff.
Jackie found information about Tony Puff on the internet, tracked what he was up to, talked to people who knew him, found people he hung out with back in 1988, and started basically conducting her own investigation. Over the years, she interviewed potential witnesses, gathered documents, and attempted to get Jason's defense files.
My ex-husband now, we were military at the time. We were stationed in Texas at Fort Hood, and that's really when my investigations, like, took a freaking, they just blew up and took off big time.
What year was
People
that?
Were calling me. Yeah. We initially got out there 2010, so 2012 at the latest, they really kicked off.
Okay.
And I actually touched base with Steve Maynard through email, and he called me. Because, you know, I let him know who I was, and I wanted to talk about this case, and he called me straight away. And he, you know, I asked him, like, you know, if I can get someone to help, can you help? He says, absolutely, I'm right there. I'm very passionate about this case, and it's not left my desk. And I said, well, I'm coming up to New Hampshire in the summer. Okay. And, you know, I told him, I said, I'd like to meet with you when I come up. He says, absolutely, let me know before you leave, and I'll clear the date. And I did as instructed. He says, okay, come on. So I had to drive to Nashua, New Hampshire, where, you know, the trials actually took place. And he said, okay, you have 5 minutes. I said, no, sir. You told me I had 1 hour.
Huh.
1 hour is what I will take. And he kind of looked past me because there was a partition wall. There was his desk and then a partition wall after that. And it was lined with nothing but Jason's files.
Wow.
So he has them. I just don't understand why he's not responding.
Jason's attorney with the New England Innocence Project then gave it a shot.
And she did a release with Jason.
just for that purpose, and she sent that out to Maynard, and he still not replied. She personally knows his daughter because she's a lawyer as well. She's reached out to her. She says, she told Cynthia herself, she goes, I've reached out to Dad. I've called Dad. I went to Dad's house, and I don't know.
Those defense files are just some of the things we hope to obtain as a result of the series. Because, as our listeners know, there's a purpose to our work. We're not just reporting for reporting's sake. The purpose of the series is to lay out the case for Jason's innocence, and to inform and educate people about the facts of the case. Because, believe it or not, even the folks closest to a case rarely know the actual facts. Everyone believes their own version of the story, but how many friends and relatives of victims and defendants go to the trouble of getting case files and figuring it out themselves, like Jackie did? It's rare, so we hope you're able to do that. To set the record straight, even for the sake of Tony, who died of an overdose 2 years ago. Because he leaves behind a son that deserves the truth about his father. Lisa Johnson, the mother of Tony's baby, rightfully has had little love lost for Tony. He wasn't around to help raise their son, was in and out of prison, had been accused of sexual assault, though the charges were dropped, and of course she thought he was a murderer all these years.
Well, he told me, like you said, when we were having a few conversations here and there once my son turned 19, so that's some years ago because he's now 33, you know, he was like, I didn't do anything. He completely said he was innocent. And I told him, he's like, I was proven innocent. I said, you were proven not guilty. You weren't proven innocent, buddy. I'm like, so I don't really know about that.
In fact, she always wondered how and why Jason was convicted, when it seemed to her that Tony and Ken should have been.
Do you have questions about, like, the case itself? Because I have.
I mean, I still always wonder. I'm like one of those. My husband laughs at me because I watch the ID channel, and he calls it the Idea Channel. I'm like, no, they all get caught, babe. Don't worry, I'm not trying to kill you. you know, and I always like wonder why was that case never on there. And I did always wonder, how did these two bozos get released and not serve any time? And this other kid, I do remember at some point talking to Jason's sister, because somehow, and I was like, I can't believe that this one kid did it all by himself and had, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But after hearing more facts about the case, Lisa had a change of heart.
So there's
that, you know, the only thing that makes me feel happy about is because my son, once he found out about this guy, has lived with the stigmatism that his father's a murderer, you know?
I'm pretty sure he's not. We're making a podcast about the case, and I will, once it starts airing, I'll send it to you because I think it would be good for you and your son to listen to, especially your son. So
yeah, I'm almost crying because my son will be so relieved.
Yeah.
To know this, because like I said, you know, he's just lived with the stigmatism and been told that basically he's guilty, and then seeing his character about getting in trouble for assaulting women, you know, he was.
Yeah.
You know, because he's a police officer, so you know, and you're a police officer, and you certainly don't go around telling people that your dad's
a
murderer.
Police officer. That's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah, actually he's a detective now. He's doing the job that these other people do.
You know what?
And I'm going to be moving to Mississippi to go be with him and my granddaughters.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, then you guys can hopefully listen to it together.
Vindicating Tony Puff was not the point of his series, but certainly it is still a worthy outcome if it brings some healing to his son. Getting back to what we hope is next for Jason Carroll, though, there is so much that can and needs to be done in this case still. There's more evidence that we hope Jason's attorneys are able to locate and collect, like a videotape collected into evidence taken from the Mall of New Hampshire on the night of the murder. A videotape taken from a store that could possibly show what time Sharon Johnson was at the mall the night she was murdered. There are missing records in the case, including chunks of discovery, even missing trial transcripts, crime scene videos, and photos that we know were taken. There are interrogation and interview tapes that Jason's team still doesn't have, and of course there's a world of DNA testing that can be done, if the physical evidence still exists. For all we know, Jason's knife and the knife collected from Ken's car and all of Sharon's clothing, jewelry, watch, glasses, the rape kit, and fingernail clippings taken from her could be sitting in an evidence locker, full of the answers to the questions we still have. None of it ever DNA tested. Only one direct appeal was ever filed in Jason's case, and it went nowhere. Jason has never had any post-conviction petition filed for him, and the aim is to get him back into court soon and ask for this evidence to be looked at again, to give him a fair chance to prove his innocence. And everyone that we've spoken to in this case has been as supportive as Sergeant Lammy about getting DNA testing done, from Thomas Sexton to Sharon's sister-in-law Diane to her daughter Melanie.
Can I ask you something else? Is how do you feel about, like, are you generally supportive of the idea of trying to get DNA testing in the case?
Well, yeah, that I'm perfectly fine with.
Okay.
You know, I'm not a person who wants to see somebody go to jail for something they didn't do, because I think that's bullshit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I just, you know, again, you got to realize I was 14 years old.
Yeah.
The whole time this trial was going on, I was 17, 18. I was pregnant with my son while going to these trials.
Yeah, yeah.
And dealing with this. And I was already heartbroken because Tony Poff was found not guilty.
Yeah.
I was heartbroken because Ken got let out of jail and acted like it was no big deal. He was only there for a year. They videotaped him walking out of Valley Street Prison down to Dunkin' Donuts. They said, "What are you doing?" "I'm gonna go get a coffee." Wow. And the guy got paid for this shit.
Wow.
He got paid for sitting in there for a year. So yeah, I was very irate. I was very heartbroken. So when Jason got 42 years chance of parole after 25, I was freaking happy.
Yeah.
I'm like, at least somebody's paying for it. At least my mother's death meant absolutely nothing. You know, I felt that there was a very minute justice being done, but not enough.
It cannot be easy for Melanie and others who loved Sharon to now know that, in fact, no justice was done at all with Jason's conviction. An interesting thing I learned about the New Hampshire legal community is this. There is a sense that the system in the state is so rigorously fair that wrongful convictions don't happen there. The National Registry of Exonerations cites only one case, a sexual assault case, in which a New Hampshire defendant's conviction was overturned by a federal court. That's it. Not a single person convicted of murder in the state of New Hampshire has been exonerated in the entire history of the state. It's encouraging to know that one of the prosecutors in Jason's case, Tina Nado, who is now a Chief Justice on the New Hampshire Superior Court, is a well-respected advocate of progressive criminal justice reform. She's been at the forefront of compassionate reform related to drug charges and addiction, and also cash bail reform, and she sits on the National Council for Criminal Justice. And we are hoping that she, along with the other powers that be, will support us potentially making New Hampshire legal history by exonerating Jason Carroll. One last thing about what the future holds for this case, and that is this. The story isn't over, or rather the coverage of the story isn't over. If your ears were sharp enough, you might have caught the sound of a third person in the car with Sarah Kalin and I in the postscript clips that we've been running at the end of every episode.
Is this common in New England? Like, we keep going up to houses that have, like, no sidewalks up to the front door?
Yes.
Do they not want people coming to the front door?
Often in a lot of, like, older houses, the front door is, like, no longer the main entrance.
This is not our old house, but they're like, true. Nope, no sidewalks for you guys. This feels very unwelcoming.
If you are a true crime podcast aficionado, you might recognize that voice as the producer and host of the blockbuster true crime show, Bear Brook.
This is Bear Brook. I'm Jason Moon.
That's right. The third person in the car was Jason Moon, senior reporter and podcaster extraordinaire with New Hampshire Public Radio.
He was also the journalist that Mr. Lammy actually called me about, the one that I told him I trusted him to speak to. The entire time Sarah and I drove around scenic New Hampshire, looking for witnesses to interview, Jason Moon was riding in the back. Most times he was stuck back there as we trudged from one home to another because we didn't want to spook the witnesses with his recording equipment, and because, yes, he was recording the entire time.
All right, so they walked in, walked around the side of the house to, I guess, knock on the front door. They're out of sight now. It'll be a very short visit, a very long one. I may be just sitting in the car alone for an hour.
It is absolutely spotless.
It's funny.
I need them to come work on my garage.
They actually might enjoy it thoroughly. I know. I'm like that. I'm
That's
like,
one of the prettiest looking garages I've ever seen.
Yeah.
All right. I cannot back out of this.
So we left my card.
Nobody answered.
Yeah, I think they're not.
All right. Where are we going next?
Yard sailing on a Saturday in New Hampshire.
It is Saturday. Well.
But there is a very good, no, great, in fact, reason that Jason endured days of being stuck in the back seat, listening to our often mindless chatter and squirrel-like ability to get distracted.
All right, so let me just, I'll just pose some questions.
Okay. Is it all right if I record this on my end, too?
Yeah, of course.
All right, ready when you are.
Okay. So, Jason, can you tell me what piqued your curiosity about this story?
Well, to be honest with you, the first thing that got me interested was the fact that you were looking into it.
The undisclosed was looking into it?
Yeah. I didn't really know anything about it before then. A lot of the characters are familiar to me as people, you know, here in New Hampshire who I've covered in other stories, who I've interviewed for other pieces and that sort of thing. But kind of the central theme of what interested me was the fact that a true crime famous, influential true crime podcast was going to be taking the case on. I kind of want to see what that means, you know, what happened when Undisclosed comes to town, you know, on a 30-year-old cold case.
You got to see how the sausage was being made, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Not that it was very impressive.
And it's been a really interesting experience because it's in a lot of ways very similar to, you know, how we make our sausage, if I can continue the metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't, you know, I haven't heard another story that kind of covers the influence of true crime media on the actual criminal justice system. You know, there have been so many famous now examples of how true crime media can actually shape outcomes and change people's lives, you know, through innocence claims and you know, your podcast or In the Dark or Making a Murderer. And I'm interested in doing a story that's like, that examines that phenomenon and captures that as it's happening, as this new force is kind of shaping the criminal justice system. Like, let's watch it play out, you know, as it happens.
Are you also interested in the particulars of the actual case? I'm curious.
Yes, I am, and partly because I don't think you could do the story without getting into that. So I think, you know, as I imagine it now, you know, I expect a story that I do will kind of, I think, kind of equally weight the two, you know, the history, the facts of the case itself, and then the kind of present day timeline of your work and the New England Innocence Project's work. And, you know, I hope that'll be an interesting story.
And I hope that when one of New Hampshire's most famous investigative journalists from the most powerful and influential media outlet in the state covers the Jason Carroll case, all of the state takes notice. That's why next year, if I were you, I'd not only keep an eye out in the courts for what happens next in Jason Carroll's case, I would also keep a lookout for a new series from Jason Moon and New Hampshire Public Radio. And we, of course, will continue to monitor the case and update you about it, even as we move on to the stories of other innocent people behind bars.
Until next time on Undisclosed. As always, a thank you to Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez for our theme music, and to Meetal Telhan for keeping the ship tight and the ball rolling as our executive producer. A special thanks to my research assistant, Jennifer Leahy, and her mom, and homicide investigator, Sarah Kalin, who was a pleasure to spend hours with riding around New Hampshire. Thanks also to Abigail Gowdy and Madison Killen, both students of Colin Miller, who did a tremendous job helping me get through discovery files. And thank you, of course, to Radha Natarajan, Cynthia Musso, and all of the New England Innocence Project for allowing us to be part of this case. Finally, thank you to the families and friends of Sharon Johnson, Tony Puff, and Jason Carroll for trusting us with the story of dear loved ones.
But I'll fill you in on how it went this morning. Yeah, so we... You're rolling?
Yeah.
Okay. I am too. So, we both need the audio. So yeah, we met with Carlene Webb and her husband, and they were lovely. And she didn't... There was not a lot she remembered. I had her review her statements. What she had a general sense of was a lot of fear. She had a lot of fear of the husband at the time, and she went through a lot of trauma. So she had a lot of professional help to get over it. And her husband was like, well, you know, when they had gotten together, it was a few months after all this had happened. And even then she was still kind of going through, like, you know, just trying to keep safe and feel safe. And she just had this overwhelming sense of fear of Ken for some reason.
And she even said that predating Sharon's murder, she felt that that Sharon was not safe at home, and that she had not expressed to her about actual physical violence, but she seemed to feel that Sharon herself felt uncomfortable at home.
Now, the real get here was when she dropped what we suspected. We talked about this yesterday, was that Sharon had shared to her just the few weeks before the murder. That she was, like, things were really bad because she had found out she was having a girl.
She did know definitively she was having a girl.
They had their mind made up that we're having
a girl. And she had expressed to Carlene, that she wasn't sure that he would love the child. And Carlene was trying to say to her, you don't even have to worry about that when the baby, everybody says they want this or they want that. When the baby's born, he'll fall in love. Yeah. And she was, according to Carlene, genuinely shaken by the prospect of telling him it was a girl.
That's that. That's my update from yesterday. All right. So we are here where she left work, and she was seen leaving work on camera at 6:30. And we're going to, do you have the address up for the convenience store?
No, not yet. I don't think you gave me that yet.
Okay, I'll figure it too.
Wow, I have a lot of thoughts about that time of day.
About what?
That time of day.
Yeah, tell me. What are your thoughts?
I'm not sure they're organized yet, okay. But I mean, primarily, know she was seen at the convenience store at around 7 because that's on camera. And then we have possible eyewitness sightings, which I am very careful with lending too much credibility to them. But since there were multiples, we'll even credit to 9:30.
Well, 7:30. 7:30 in the mall by two women.
Right, but what was the fight outside the mall?
That was 9:40.
9:40. But in that window of time, we know that the girls say that Ken was not at home.
He was not home until after 10.
Until after 10, and that puts him squarely with no alibi, mud all over his car, and you know.
It seems pretty... Open and shut? Detective? Yeah. Okay.
It's my case, which it's not.
Yeah, I think the investigators then also...
I think they did, too.
...believed it.
But sure, I don't, and this is something I've arrived at, and again, there's still more documents that I could review and whatever, but I think he did it and he acted alone. It was just him. This is, you know, this idea that maybe he did it with somebody else or anything. He killed her by himself and brought her to that site and dumped her there and then couldn't get his story straight.
What was it? It was 220
Middlesex.
Middlesex.